The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled The Allocation of Scarce Medical Resources, is dedicated to the merit and honor of the Tapper families.
In a controversial move, the state of Oregon is preparing to expand its Medicaid program to include a greater number of its uninsured residents. It is planning to afford the increased coverage, however, by refusing to insure certain expensive medical procedures, such as treatment for end-stage cancer and liver transplants. In other words, this new policy seems to imply that those that are privileged enough to afford the newest technology and treatment will live. Those that aren't may be doomed to die. For many, this is a very disturbing concept. Does society have the right to refuse someone life-extending medical treatment just because he or she cannot afford it? And if we do have the right to ration medical care, what should the guidelines be? Should age be a factor, or the terminal nature of the patient, or the likelihood of successive treatment? The controversy over rationing health care, of course, is not just limited to Oregon. The Clinton administration, in its attempt to expand health benefits to more people while trying to regulate spiraling costs, will confront the same gripping ethical issue. It's a problem that will not just go away by itself. Advances in technology, machines, drugs, and improved methods of treatment of treating patients have been responsible for the continuing 4 to 5% annual rate of growth in healthcare costs, with absolutely no end in sight. Unfortunately, the collective wisdom of society to properly allocate its scarce resources has not seen such an increase. The questions that society is now struggling with, however, are not entirely new. For thousands of years, students of the Talmud have dealt with the same issues and have compiled an extensive literature. I would like to take this opportunity this morning to share with you some of their wisdom and perhaps provide some insight into their methodology. You've all received an outline of this lecture. Please now follow with me as we deal with the first topic. Can we refuse treatment because of cost? The Talmud, the Gemara in Sanhedrin 9 Gimel Amud Aleph in 73a, discusses the issue of what is our responsibility to involve ourselves to save someone else. The Gemara, first of all, bases the responsibility on an extension of the requirement to retrieve a lost object. If an object is lost, one is required to involve himself, an animal, a watch, to try to find to locate the owner, to help the individual. The Gemara finds alluded to in the same scripture a responsibility to help a person if he's lost, if a person's in danger. Vashevais Eloi is a responsibility to help the person himself. But beyond the mitzvahs aseh, the positive commandment, there's also a negative commandment. Lo samad al dam rayecha. Don't stand idly by as your neighbor's blood is being spilled. And therefore, the Gemara makes the comment that the necessity, why the Torah had to go out of its way to command us, besides the positive commandment, but also the negative, don't stand idly by, but rather the implication is do something, includes the extra, as the Ron says, the yitur hakosov, the fact is the redundancy and the reinforcement of the concept is to include the fact As it says in your first, if you notice, this is on section one, in paragraph A, this requirement extends to make the effort to hire help if need be. In other words, if you can't help yourself, you see someone's drowning or someone's attacked, you're required to make the effort to expend the monies to hire someone to help. There's a question, this is the first part of this discussion. Does the Gemara mean to say, therefore, that I really have to undergo an out-of-pocket burden? I have to actually pay out of my pocket to save someone? Or merely the Gemara is saying that I would have implied just by the fact that if I would only have a positive commandment, return a lost object, well, you yourself have to return it. If you can't, well, you just can't. Here the Torah says, well, if you just can't save, do something and let somebody else save it. Go call for help. But not necessarily does it mean, even when I hire help, that I have to undergo the out-of-pocket costs. In fact, as we're going to see, there's a whole body of opinion that the person himself, the one who is being saved, has to ultimately bear the burden of the expense of being of what it took to hire the people. Because I can give him basically a loan. I will go and hire out, says, all these workers to go and to help him and then have the machinery or what's involved to save the person, but ultimately the person, the recipient of this of the help, will have to pay. What this one major variable that will define what's my requirement to pay is based on a principle which we have now in paragraph B, section 1. The Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, in the Ramosha Israelis, in his glosses to the Shulchan Aruch Yoredeya, says Kufnun Zion, says 157, gives a situation when one is faced with violating one of the commandments of the Torah. Even if it wouldn't be a question of Shabbos, it would be a question of some person would have to eat something that one person's in, that finds himself in a town. There's no kosher food. He wants to keep kosher. In order for him to, and if he doesn't eat, if he's going to starve to death, the only thing available is non-kosher food. For him to eat kosher food would demand, he'd have to give up really all his money. I mean, he would have an exorbitant amount of money he would have to expend in order to keep kosher. What is the cost of keeping kosher? There's a negative commandment. One says that one shouldn't eat from certain animals, whatever. So the Ramah says that when we're dealing with any negative commandment, that thou shalt not, if it's just merely a question of money, one is required to expend basically all one's savings, all one's capital, to avoid violating that which the Torah says, do not. Whether it be to eating or Shabbos, or inflicting hurt on someone else. One is required, when it comes to a negative commandment, one is required, in order to avoid the violation, to give up all that he has. When it comes to a positive commandment, though, the positive commandment to help, to give tzedakah, to give charity, that same demand is not there. There's a question, what seems to be a disagreement between the Babylonian Talmud and the Palestinian Talmud, the Talmud Bavli and Talmud Yerushalmi, as to what the limit is. From the Gemara and Ksubas, it's a sugim daf memtes and daf nun, it would seem that one is not allowed to give more than a fifth. In other words, one has to be concerned when it comes to do mitzvahs, not to become impoverished himself. Therefore, one is not allowed to give more than a fifth. From the Yerushalmi and Peah, it seems that one is only is required to give up to a fifth and may give even more than a fifth. And this is how the Rambam, in his commentary on the Mishnayos, learns the Mishnah and Peah, that there are certain things that have no limit. This is something we say in the davening every day, when there's Gemilas Chasodim. And the Yerushalmi makes the point that doing kindness has no limit within the kind of kindness that there's not out-of-pocket expense, visiting the sick, going to a wedding, helping people. When it comes to out-of-pocket expenses, there is a limit, and the Rambam quotes the Yerushalmi, the limit is one is not required to give more than a fifth. But one may give more. The Chofetz Chaim, Yisroel Meir Kagan, in his work, the Abbas Chesed, wants to resolve the seeming contradiction between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi by saying that there are two different situations that one may be faced with in giving charity, doing something good. The Bavli is speaking about a situation where there are no poor right now. The need is not pressing, but I want to set aside monies upon the occasion when the poor will come, if the need does arise. If I'm going to set aside for the future, I'm not allowed to set aside more than a fifth. That's the limit. The Yerushalmi, though, is speaking about a situation when the poor are knocking at my door. The need is here. In that situation, I'm not prescribed from giving more than a fifth. And in fact, I'm required to give. If the need is really pressing, I'm required to give up to a fifth. If the needs of these people are not met with less than a fifth, I have to give up to a fifth. And the Yerushalmi makes the point, in terms of just as a hypothetical situation, a person is an heir to a huge fortune. When he receives the fortune, he has to take, and again, we're seeing about the situation that the need is pressing, he has to put away, give away one-fifth of his inheritance. From that time on, and beyond that, he's free. From that time on, any interest that's accumulated, that any profit that he makes from his inheritance, he has to subsequently give up to a fifth, if need be. That's a situation where we're dealing with positive commandments. When it comes to saving a person's life, we have a mixed situation of sorts. The language of the Torah is do not stand idly by, which is a negative commandment. Don't means don't stand idly by. But the implication is, but do something. So implied, it's a positive commandment. But in the formulation, in the wording, it's a negative commandment. Does a negative commandment, which is a shev, which is a, basically the negative is a shev al tasa, in other words, don't sit there, do something, have with it the same teeth of a regular negative commandment? In other words, when it comes to a regular negative commandment, to avoid it, one must give up all his wealth. Not one's life, but his wealth. When it comes to a positive commandment, only a fifth. How do we look at this situation? And in Yoredeya, says in 157.1, the Pisrei Tshuva brings a variant opinions about the matter. The Rivosh, and this is quoted, this is the end of the quote in paragraph B, in his response in 387, Shinpei Zion maintains it doesn't make a difference. Even a negative commandment, even when the implication is to do something, the fact that it was formulated as a don't, one is required to give up all one's wealth to avoid it. Based on that, in a relatively recent response, Rav Henoch Egish, This is in paragraph C, who was the author of the Marcheshes. He was one of the Dayonim, one of the judges in the rabbinical court in Vilna before World War II. In his work, the Marcheshes maintains that even though we know when it comes to redeeming captives, there's a certain cap. You don't redeem over a certain price. It seems that one, you collect for captives as you collect for any tzedakah, and there's the limit of a fifth. But if the captive is in truly in mortal danger, there's imminent danger, he is condemned to die, one is required to give up all his wealth, one's wealth, to save the person. And there's one has to go into, there's no limit. The fifth limit does not apply. And so to the Chofetz Chaim and Avos Chesed, as you see in section 2, in the 20th parak, the 20th chapter, maintains the same. When it comes to saving a life, money is no limit. One is required to give more than a fifth. In the commentaries in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, one of the major commentaries in Sanhedrin was Rav Meir Halevi, the Rama, who lived in the 13th century in Spain. He maintains that one is not required to give up one's wealth to save somebody. The Gemara, which we quoted before, that one has to hire help, merely means one has to make the effort to hire help. But ultimately, the burden of paying for this is the recipient of the aid, and the community does not have to help him. I mean, probably not more than the fifth, like any tzedakah. The Tosfos HaRosh, this is the Rosh of Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel, one of the great Rabbonim who lived both in Germany and Spain in the 14th century, learns up the sugya in the same manner. That the Gemara is not implying that one has to give up one's wealth, merely one has to make an extra effort. One has to give out the loan. As we see, there are two schools of thought. One is the prohibition, do not stand idly by, is dealt with as all other prohibitions of the Torah, and therefore one is required to make the effort, if need be, to give up all one's wealth. Or the other school of thought is, we deal with it like tzedakah, like charity. I mean, it's a mitzvah, one should help, but one doesn't have to undergo the burden of poverty in doing so. And we have the fifth limit. According to how the Chofetz Chaim learns in Yerushalmi, the limit is one is required up to a fifth, and one may give more than a fifth. There was a recent question which was posed to the author of the Tzitz Eliezer, or Eliezer Waldenberg, one of the great decisors of Jewish law in Eretz Yisrael. He is the resident rabbi of Shari Tzedek Hospital. There was a question posed to him, I don't believe it was in Shari Tzedek Hospital, it was a doctor in one of the other hospitals. The hospital in which this particular doctor was on staff had the policy, basically, when a terminal patient would come in, a patient that would be very little hope of survival, they would not resuscitate, they would not put the person on the ventilator. That was the hospital's policy. The person who asked the question felt by Jewish law one is required, as we're going to extend life. And in fact, the commandment of don't stand idly by does not just mean don't stand idly by and save the person totally, but seems as well don't stand idly by, but one is required to extend a life even though there may be a terminal patient. There's a Gemara in Yuma. Yoma says in Pehei Amud Aleph in 85a about a building that collapsed on someone, and so the person is going to die, but one is allowed to unearth the building and to remove the person, even though he may only live for a short period of time, chayesha, an hour, 2 hours. Even for a short period of time is one required to be mechal Shabbos, to desecrate Shabbos. Because of a life, even chayesha, even a little bit of life is important. And it's normally understood that the prohibition, leisamar al dam reyecha, don't stand idly by, applies to that kind of a life as well. At least that's the how it's normally understood. So the question was asked Rabbi Waldenberg, if one is required to make the effort to save this person, or at least to extend his life, even though maybe a short period of time, but one is required to make that effort, therefore, even though it's against hospital policy, I should do what I can. But I know I'll only be able to do this for a short period of time before I'm fired. I mean, since that is hospital policy, and the hospital won't tolerate someone who's going against policy, in all likelihood, I'm going to lose my job. And if since that is evidently this is becoming policy in a wider and wider area, I may lose my whole livelihood. Am I required to lose my livelihood over this issue? That was his question. And that's basically what is the extent that one is required to make the effort. In a similar question, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, also one of the great poskim, one of the great gedolim, great Talmudic scholars in Yerushalayim, made a distinction between chayei shoah and chayei olam. It wasn't a written response, but verbally, he maintained, at least in this situation where it's a matter of extending one's life, one does not require to lose one's job. He left open the question, though, if it's a question of actually saving a person rather than just merely extending his life for a few days or hours or what. Rav Waldenberg answered, based on the opinion of the Ramah and the Tosfos HaRosh in paragraph C, section 2, that one is not required to lose money over the issue of saving a life. According to his opinion, it goes really far beyond the particular issue of the doctor losing his job and his livelihood. Really, it's a question in a broader sense of what is our responsibility to allocate our resources. How much is the community responsible to give to save lives? According to Waldenberg, it would seem, or at least according to the opinion that he bases himself on, when it comes to policy, society does have a rationale to say, well, we just can't afford it. That's not to say that perhaps where we're allocating our funds now could be better spent towards saving lives. And perhaps some of the money that's spent in our space program, for instance, to contact terrestrial intelligence maybe diverted to help people that, you know, to for research or to have, you know, for the future, to help people that are now that are in a critical situation. But assuming that there are no extra funds in the budget, it would seem, at least according to that opinion, that there is a rationale of rationing. The society, as a society, is not required to give up more than a certain amount. Of course, according to the first opinion of Marcheshes and the Avos Chesed, one actually would be required that really this limit would not apply. I don't know, in terms of what we're saying with the introduction about Hillary Clinton, in the yeshivas, usually when they go and ask you a shaila, the first response is, well, it's a machloikas. You know, there's a disagreement about this. But Rabbi Waldenberg, at least when it came to a personal situation, quite possible it could be extended, that there are grounds to make the opinion that there are limits that society has to contribute. On the other hand, we see from the Ramah, the Tosfos HaRosh, a very interesting an interesting situation as well. It seems my responsibility to help, according to them, is one of tzedakah, one of charity. And as if the person cannot afford, we as a community, as a charitable community, are required to intervene. But what happens if the person is a person of means? Well, the person himself has to pay, which is an interesting... Of course, if we're, you know, a person that's pooled his resources into an insurance fund, basically all of them are shutvim of sorts, are partners in this, you know, in this fund. But beyond that, when it comes to a transplant, a liver transplant that will cost $200,000, it would seem that society really would, even in, if it's a question of tzedakah, society would only have to bear the costs where the beyond where the person's resources himself have been spent. But to the extent that a person has the resources to spend for such a thing, one, the person himself is required to. Because we are not, at least according to the Ramah and the Tos HaRosh, we are not required to pay for treatment where the person himself has the ability to pay for himself. I'd like to go on to the next section. And if we do have a limited amount of resources to help someone, who comes first? In other words, how do we determine priority in treatment? The idea of priority, we find a model, not just in the health field, but in the field of chesed, in the field of charity. In section 2, in paragraph A, there's a Gemara in Bava Metzia, 9 Aleph Omid Aleph, and 71a, that deals with the question about there's a mitzvah, there's a commandment of the Torah, to offer an interest-free loan to those, you know, to those that are... to those who are in need. When it comes to a loan, in different periods of one's life, even one has a person of tremendous wealth, one may need a loan. Just in terms to tide oneself over, one has a problem of cash flow. If there are two people come for you for a loan, one is a man, a person of means, who needs the loan, and one is a person who's indigent, who's impoverished. There, the Gemara says that the poor come before the rich. And if it's a question of two people, one from your own city, and from the poor from another city, then the people of your city come first. As we in the section B, this idea, we find a similar idea not in loans but in actually in giving charity. Those with greater needs take precedence. And the Sifri, this is the halachic midrash on Bamidbar and Dvorim, on Numbers and Deuteronomy, and 15:7, which deals with with charity. It starts off, the scripture deals with the Evyon, the utterly destitute. And the Sifri makes the comment that those with greater need take precedence. So I have a question of two people need charity, but one hasn't eaten for days. Okay, it's not a question he's going to, he needs to go on a diet anyway. But one hasn't eaten for days, there's a real hunger there. And the other person is, needs, but is not the same. It's not the same level. One is required to give the one with greater need. Tov tov koidem. Beyond that, if everything else equal. Then there's the priorities are in terms of my relation with the person. A paternal half brother takes precedence over a maternal half brother. Mishpacha sav kruya mishpacha. Family comes first. and those of your city take precedence of another city. If there are two people that are coming outside of your city, one is from Israel, and one is from Chutz Loritz, is from another city outside of Israel, those of Israel take precedence. This is all in the Sefarim. According to the Bach and the Shach, those of your city always take precedence. There's the Chassam Sofer expands this idea in a response. And he claims that the poor of Yerushalayim, of Jerusalem, have a precedence over the poor of other cities in Israel. There's the idea of Kodesh Kodesh Kodem. Those that are more sanctified take precedence. And this is an idea we're going to shortly cover. But he says, if the poor of the other city's needs are more pressing, then the other city takes precedence. Now, the first thing is we deal with is need. After that, then we deal with relations. It would seem, I mean, not clear, but it would seem, if we are dealing in a situation in the United States, and there's a question of a patient coming from out of the country who needs help, and I cannot fulfill the needs of everyone who's coming to my hospital, those of my country come first, everything else being equal. It would seem, at least from the Chassam Sofer, though, if the needs of the one who's outside of the country is that much more pressing, there would be grounds, perhaps, to treat the one outside of the country. The Tana, in section C, it's into the Tana de Ve'eliyahu, this is a medrash, that even goes with greater detail as the hierarchy of who should I help first. And he says, first of all, everyone knows charity begins at home. After that, one's parents, if they need. After that, one's brothers and sisters. Beyond the brothers and sisters, one's wider family. With any remaining money, one helps one's immediate neighbors, the Shechenim. Just, you know, the guys. You know. And with any remaining money, it goes to the people on the language of Tana Ve'eliyahu is the Mavoi. Mavoi was a long... We don't really have a mavoi. I translate a street, which is the closest to it. In England, they have a thing called mews. It's really an alleyway, and there are courtyards that come off of it, and it's really a subsection of the city. But your area comes first. I guess those of Oak Park, if you live in Oak Park, or those of, you know, even though it would be Greater Detroit. One, in allocating, one's first responsibility is to one's community, to one's family. It's interesting, we find in paragraph D about what defines need. Up until now, we've discussed need as a pressing need. One person A is more hungry than person B. In section D, we deal what about psychological pain. If a boy and a girl orphan come for financial assistance, we assist the girl first, then the boy. The boy finds it easier to beg. Again, we're dealing with a potential beggar. A girl's shamed. A boy and a girl come, they need assistance for a wedding. Again, the embarrassment of the girl is felt much more. Translating this into medical parameters. There's a Tosfos in Shabbos, a Nun Amud Beis in 50b, that speaks about mental anguish, tsar. And says that mental anguish, just as one is medicinally, one is allowed to do certain procedures, SARS is because if a person has mental anguish because he looks disfigured, it's considered SAR. It's a real pain. It doesn't have to be a physical pain. a psychological pain, a feeling of hurt is a real hurt. Based on that, one has to really, if two people are coming in for a procedure, again, one cannot treat both of them, or if we're dealing with national policy. But one is a question not only of physical pain, but of disfigurement, of embarrassment. One can't walk in the streets without being the center of everyone's attention. It would seem from the Gemara that is a real concern. And when I allocate priorities of a person who is going to be disfigured or feel so, perhaps could even have priority over someone who has real pain. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, a Memhei, a Medalef, and a Gemara in Soita, and a Dav Chesom and Beis, about the question in terms of when they condemned someone to death. One of the forms of capital punishment was stoning. And there was a question as to, in the process of being stoned, the less clothes one had, the faster it would go. But having less clothes would make the condemned person feel more embarrassed. What should we do? Should we make it go faster? In other words, have the person the least clothes as possible undergo this, so the death should go in a very fast and immediate manner? Or should we clothe the person? He should at least feel honored and shouldn't be embarrassed, even though the pain of the death may be all the more. And according to the halacha, according to the majority opinion, is that this bizyoni, that embarrassment is more important than tsar, than physical pain. The psychological pain is all the more important. If you notice your notes here in section E, continuing on the idea of importance and need, normally we say a person comes before, person's needs come before all. But if a person is in captivity with his mother, one has to redeem one's mother first, because of the indignities she may, as a woman, she may experience in the hands of her captors. Need comes evidently before relations. But there's another factor besides need and besides relations, and that's status. If you turn the page, which is the last two entries in the top of the page, are based on the Gemara in Horius 13a. We find, says that in setting priorities, two people are drowning, I can only save one. Two people are in captivity, I can only redeem one. Who should I redeem? The one who has a greater position in society comes first. That's the kodesh kodesh kodem. One who's sanctified has precedence. A scholar comes before a king. Interestingly, the Gemara says anyone could be a king. And it takes more to be a scholar. You could say that about being a president too, I guess. But even in the hierarchy of the priesthood, for instance, one who has a higher position comes first. One wonders if two people are coming to an emergency room, and one is the President of the United States. Oh, I don't know, give a better mush. One is a person that is that does much help to other people, and the other is a poshut mensch, it's a simple person. It would seem, at least according to the guideline based on the Gemara and Horius, that if my saving not only is a question of I'm interfacing with this person, but it has a broad ramification for the community at large, I have to take that into the whole equation. I can't just look at, well, they're two people. Well, if you look at people, every person is the same. In fact, there's a famous Gemara, This will be quoted later on. There's a famous Gemara. If you just go down the page in section 3 in paragraph C, someone came to Rava and he was thinking that the governor of his, where he was, gave him the option that I want you to assassinate that person or I, the governor, will assassinate you. And he came to Rava for advice. What should he do? And Rava told him, says, who says your blood is redder than his? You can't kill someone to save your own life. When it comes to actually killing someone, there's no difference whoever the victim is, if it's whatever his position in society is. You just can't kill someone. However, if it's a question, I'm not actively killing someone, I can only save one person, there are two people in need, then other things may come into my decision. The scholar says all the whole nation needs the scholar. If it would be a king and a commoner, you'd save the king. And in the hierarchy of the kahuna, one who has a higher position is saved over the one of the lower position. And so too in society. Interestingly enough, as you know, a note on 6 on the top of the page, it says, Mamzer Talmud Chochem, a scholar, even if he be a Mamzer, in other words, born of an adulterous, incestuous relation, which would, in terms of the level of society, in terms of he's not allowed in most situations to marry, but by the fact he is a scholar, comes before a high priest if that high priest is not learned. And the scholarship evidently is of the highest importance, at least according to the Talmud. So really, when it comes to allocating, there are other things do come into play. But up until now, we've discussed these three factors: need, relationship, and status. When it comes basically to things which are basically in the same ballpark, people both are sick, one is a little more sick, more pain, more psychologically impaired than the other. But there are differences not of kind. And here we're going to introduce the idea of chaye shah, which we've touched upon before. There's a situation where I can save someone. There's another situation that I can only prolong his life. I can't save the person. When it comes to chilul Shabbos and violating Shabbos, there's no difference between chaye olam and chaye shah. It makes no difference. Of saving a person, extending a person's life, one's required to violate Shabbos. But what happens in a situation where I'm faced with one person's chaye olam, one person to save one person or to extend another person's life? Or perhaps a situation of two people come in front of me, there's only one hospital bed, I'm operating the emergency section of the hospital. One person will definitely die. However, I can if I act now, I will be able to extend his life. Maybe a few hours, maybe a few days. I can't cure him, but I could extend his life. The other person is, there's a suffix, I don't know. If I'm successful, I'll be able to save his life. He'll be able to live a long and successful life. On the other hand, he may die. One is a suffix, one is in doubt, if I'm going to save. The other one is, I definitely won't save, but I definitely will extend. Who comes first? And I'd like to go through with you the sources. Just to make you familiar, even though very often, even when it comes to in the yeshiva situation where you're learning, you may not come to a clear solution, but basically to make you familiar with the methodology. How do we glean from the source material at least the decisions that we do make, or on what basis these decisions are made? There's a Gemara in Bava Metzia, Samach Beis Amud Aleph, in 62a. Two people are on a road. It's a lonely road. It's in the desert. There's only one canteen of water. If they both drink, they'll both eventually die. It's too far to make it to civilization, to the nearest water source. But if only one person would use this canteen, he'd be able to make it. There's some down the road, there's some spring, or there's some town, or he'll be able to live. What should he do? Now, two people, A and B, A owns the water. What should he do? Ben Petura's opinion is that it's preferred that they both drink, even though eventually one of them is going to, they're both going to die. His language is, it's better that they both drink than not one witnesses the death of his comrade. This one takes all the water for oneself and is the cause of the other's death of sorts. And this is in a passive form. Rabbi Akiva taught that preserving one's own life comes first, chayecha koidim. And therefore, the one who owns the water should drink. There's a question that's posed. What we've seen from other sources, it seems that charity begins at home. In a situation of a charity, one is not required to give up all one's money to help society. One has to take care of one's own needs first. It would seem then, normally, the one would say, says, you should save yourself. On what basis does Ben Petura maintain that one should go out and save and both die? Logic, I mean, at least the model that we have from charity would dictate that the person should save himself. There are various approaches to this problem. The Chazon Ish of Rami Yeshaya Karelitz, who's one of the great scholars of the mid-20th century, passed away in 1953. He maintained that actually this was a question, as we said, of Chaye Oilom versus Chaye Shah, saving someone versus extending someone's life. Ben Petura maintained that they're all the same. There's a requirement to save. I'm required to save myself. I'm required to save somebody else. For the next day, if we both drink, we will live. I can extend my friend's life an extra day, as well as extending myself. I can extend his life without compromising mine for one day. When it comes to the second day, it's all over, but for one day, me and my friend are the same. Ben Petura maintained that it's a win-win situation. I don't have to look at Chaye Olam. I can just take a myopic view. Assuming we both drink, we'll both live a day. If I take the water, then I will live forever. I mean, till I get to the next town. He will die tonight. It'll be all over for him. So Ben Petura says, take every day at a time. Says, right now, I could save him and save myself for today. He says, I worry about today. I don't have to worry about tomorrow. Rabbi Akiva, on the other hand, maintained that my Chaye Olam, my life, the Chaye Olam takes precedence, saving oneself takes precedence over Chaye Shah. over savings is temporary life. In other words, let's not take this situation. Two people are in need, assuming they're both the same. They're both scholars, they're both kings, they're both whatever they are. Nothing. There's no other variable except one I can save and one I can extend. This Chaye Olam comes first. To save comes first than to extend. This is how he learns this is how the Chazon Ish learns the Gemara. And it would come out, and this is the overriding principle. We see that principle of Chaye Olam versus Chaye Sha in a different setting, which is now, this is in section 3, paragraph B. There was a situation there in the Gemara someone was in a critical situation. He was bitten by a snake, really. If nothing would be done to the person would die. The only physician that was available to treat this person was someone who was suspected of that he, just because of hate for Jews, would kill the patient. Is the patient allowed to take the risk of using such a doctor? I mean, he may not kill the patient. It's like using a Nazi doctor, basically. It's a Jewish patient. No, and really that situation did occur after the war. People were released from the camps, and many of the doctors still on staff were Nazis. And they did their measure of, it's documented, their measure of killing as well. So the situation, a patient is in need, is going to a doctor, if nothing is done for him, for the patient will die. What should be done? Is the person allowed to put oneself in the situation that, what should I do? The choices are, if nothing is done, the patient will live for a day, for instance. If the doctor intervenes and commits murder, the person is going to live just for a few minutes. On the other hand, if the doctor is successful, the person will live, out a regular life. Is a person allowed to make the choice? And the Gemara comes out that Chaye Olam, to save someone, even if it's a suffix, it's only a question, takes precedence over Chayesha, over temporal life. In other words, the person was allowed to let the doctor deal with him because the chances were so, on the other hand, he may be saved. Even though the possibility is his life may be, may end a lot sooner. Based on this principle, the Gemara says in the recent responsa maintained that one is allowed to undergo, for instance, an operation where it's quite possible the patient may die on the operating table. And if the person doesn't undergo the operation, one would say, well, the person will live for I don't know how long, a month, a few days, a few weeks. But if the operation is successful, though, person will live out a regular life. And based on that, Gemara Avodah Zarah, this is used as the citation that one is allowed to put oneself in that situation. So Chaye Olam, it seems that to be saved, to be cured, even if it's a suffix, even if it's only in doubt, takes precedence over Chaye Sha, only extending life. What happens, though, even if we've determined two people come to me, one is Chaye Olam, one is Chaye Sha, one is I'm going to save, possibly. The other was I am definitely going to extend. The one that I'm going to save, even on a suffix, on a doubt, comes first. But what happens if the one that I'm going to extend got to the bed first? Yes. He entered into the hospital first. I only have one machine. I'm very limited. The person came first. Now the next person who I could possibly cure comes second. What should I do? Now, I'm not speaking about, you know, we're speaking about all the suits that, you know, forget about the legal ramifications over here. Just strictly in terms of halakha, what should I do? You know, things aren't easy. You know? Rav Moshe Feinstein, in a responsa, it's printed in the, there's a work, it's called Refuah V'Halacha, out of Israel. And the responsa maintains that if the person got to the bed, if the one who needs extended life got to the bed first, he's in. He has the right. You can't push him aside to treat the other patient. However, that view is not maintained by everyone. As we see now, as you see in section 3, paragraph C, which we've quoted before about the situation, if you don't kill him, I will kill you. What happens if the person that is going to be assassinated is someone whose status in halacha, in Jewish law, is inferior? His protection under law is less than the theoretical, the possible assassin. For instance, it is, according to Jewish law, one is not allowed to perform an abortion. It's a form, at least from B'nai Noach, most certainly for non-Jews, and it would seem to apply to Jews as well. It's a minor form of killing. However, when it comes to Jewish law, if one kills a viable child, one who's been born, who's functioning, the punishment for murder is death, under certain, you know, of course, under with proper witnesses, and but the punishment is death. If one kills a fetus, one is not put to death. So the status of a viable person is a higher nature than that of a fetus. Or, second case, a trefa, someone who has a mortal wound. One has a puncture, and as long as no medical treatment, the person is just going to die. The person's going to die anyway. He's mortally wounded. If I would kill a trefa, I wouldn't be put to death. I'm not allowed to do it. I'm not allowed to hasten anyone's death. But a person whose the body is no longer really functioning, there's a hole somewhere, there's a... that person, a trefa, is a considered a different level of life, and at least there's no death penalty associated with severing that life. Now, a situation is, again, we'll get the Gomorrah situation back. The governor of the city, the mayor of the city, tells this person, says, you kill that fetus, or you kill that trefa, that person who's mortally wounded, you just kill him now, and if you don't, I'm going to kill you. What then? The Rabbah's response is, who says your blood's redder than his blood, may be countered, yes, my blood is redder. Because if someone takes my life, he'll be put to death. Someone takes that life, the person's not put to death. I have a situation of redder blood. Sort of. There's no hematologist here, right? According to the Michas Chinuch, he maintains, again, Mishkan was not a book of response. It wasn't halacha lemaisa, and it wasn't literature that was written to fulfill practically. It was written in terms of just as a general understanding of the Torah. But his opinion is that one would be allowed. It seems though the Rambam, they want to say, would take a different approach. The Rambam maintains, it would seem, that even though the person, the victim, is inferior, still he is offered protection under law, and we could still say you are not allowed to take that life, even though yours may seem superior. The Rambam maintains there is a It's a mishnah in Olas, and it's in the seventh, in the end of the seventh chapter. About it's a situation where a woman is giving birth, and it's a very difficult birth. If nothing is done, the woman is going to die. There, the Gemara says, if the head has emerged already, one is not allowed to kill the child. The child is considered born. You don't push aside one soul for another soul. Both are entitled to life. This is not a situation where both will die. That's discussed in another. If I don't touch it, the child will live. Even if the mother dies, I'll be able to somehow to save the child. However, if the child's head is not emerged yet, I am required to save the mother and kill the child. Rashi seems to say, because you save the mother because the life of the child is inferior to that of the mother. It hasn't been born yet. It's only a fetus. The status of the fetus is an inferior status to that of the mother. The Rambam maintains you kill the child because the child is a roidef. He is a killer. He is killing the mother, the fetus. It's a very difficult passage of the Rambam. There's much literature about it, that somehow it's a quasi-rodef. There's a section called the rodef, the pursuer. One who pursues someone to kill is an outlaw, is denied the protection under law. Actually, one is required to kill the rodef, to kill the pursuer, to save the intended victim. There are two types of pursuers. There's one who pursues consciously, and there's one is by force of nature, somehow is in a situation not of his making to be the pursuer. The fetus is a situation, as the Gemara says, Mishamayim Karat Filei. It's from heaven. It is thrust. The fetus is not of its own making. It didn't decide to be a pursuer. Situation is, though, and beyond its control, it is being a pursuer, not consciously so. In order to kill a viable, this is the Rambam's opinion, to kill a viable child, once the head has emerged, the person has to be a bona fide pursuer. In other words, has to make a decision he's going to pursue, then he loses his status. The person is considered an outlaw, and you're allowed to kill the person. However, there's a quasi-status of pursuer, like the fetus, that in that situation, at least, when you have doubled with that, the question of who should I save, the mother or the fetus, coupled with the fact is that the fetus is the cause of the death of the mother, one is allowed to kill the fetus. It's a very difficult concept. It's very controversial. But whatever it is, the Rambam, it needs to have some other source to kill the fetus. Merely by the fact that because the fetus will live, the mother will die. You know, if the fetus is not actually actively killing that mother, we would not have a right to touch the fetus. For instance, let's say there is a situation where the mother has some sort of a sickness, that if she will, that in order to, there's, she has some sort of a tumor, that the only way to operate on that tumor is to kill the child. You just can't get to it. The kid is not killing the mother, the tumor is killing the mother. It's just the kid is in the way. Are you allowed to kill that child to save the mother? According to Rashi, yes. According to the Rambam, no. You could only kill the mother. You could only kill the fetus if that fetus is a pursuer, is a rodef. Otherwise, you can't. Because even though it's an inferior form of life, that life has to respect it as well. According to that, you know, to that body of opinion, in the situation of kill the fetus, or I will kill you, you would not be allowed to kill the fetus. But according to Minchas Chinuch, you are. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, in a responsa, to this is there's a sefer called Nishmas Avraham by Rabbi Avraham. Avraham, this is his last name. maintains the, in a in an oral responsa, maintains like the Rambam that one is not allowed to kill. So if I have a situation here of a treif, if someone is mortally wounded, let's say he's a terminal patient, and I only have one, and I only have one ventilator, and the treif is on the ventilator, and it's a question now to remove the ventilator from the one who's mortally wounded, and to put it to somebody who I could actually save, but in removing the ventilator, I am in effect killing the, you know, the treif, killing the one who's mortally wounded. Rosh Shlomo Zalman says, I can't do that. I can't take one life, even though maybe a very, the quality of that life may be very small, to save another life. Similarly, I mean, basically, as we have the person who is not a treif, doesn't have a mortal wound, and this, but a person is terminally ill, the person is definitely going to die. Most certainly one would not be allowed to take off the ventilator from the one and to put it on the other. It's only a situation when two people come in front of you at once, and I could help either A or B, then I have the choice and I would opt to where can it be most effective. There I treat the person of Chaye Oilam, the person I could potentially save. If the other person comes first, once I'm involved with him, I can't leave him. I can't cause his death to treat the other person. And this is Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach rules. But as I said before, says this is not the only opinion. The Tiferes Yisroel, one of the major commentators on the Mishnah. And with this, I'll leave it open to questions. Brings a fascinating Gemara, which he maintains would seem to imply the opposite. But just to share the Gemara with you, there's a Gemara in Nedorim. Those who learn Daf Yomi will appreciate it. Maybe it's a long while I forgot already. There's a Gemara in 22a. Ula was going from outside of Israel to Israel with two people, Bnei Chazoi, two people from Chazoi. There's a question where Chazoi is located. Opinions that it's in Kazakhstan, as it refers to a place in Asia. But there were two Jews. Evidently, these two Jews got into a fight. One slit the throat of the other. So one had this knife, slit the throat of his friend. The blood is turned to Ula. Says, what did you think about what I did? I guess Ula was a little scared. So he said, you know, you should do a better job. You should cut it better. You know, pra beis hashchita. In other words, cut it better. In effect, at least this is the argument of the Tiferes Yisroel, really he hastened that person's death. Because he said, I mean, he was going to die. He's a treifa. In other words, he's mortally wounded. He is going to die. And he told him, you know, do a better job. Evidently, he saved himself, Ula, by encouraging the other one. Says, I'm on your side. You know, I want to help you out. On the other hand, it comes the ethical problem. How could he cause, at least hasten somebody else's death by saving his own? And the Tiferes Yisroel maintains we see the principle not like, would seem to be more like that of the Minchas Chinuch, not like the opinions I brought before. The one is allowed to, at least in such a situation, to hasten someone's death. This person is terminally ill, he's going to die, isn't it? His throat is cut. To hasten that death to save one's own. So in that situation, we see perhaps a dissenting opinion that one can make that decision. But lemay halacha lemaisa, as it seems a consensus of the decisors of Jewish law, is that one is not allowed to do so. That even this is only extending a person's life, one cannot extinguish one person's life to save another's. Okay, I'm open to any questions. Yeah, the question was asked about the term terminally ill here. It would be here in section 3, paragraph E. This terminally ill would not necessarily be a goses. It could also be. The goses is the person who is really in the death throes. This is not necessarily a goses. But one, it's just a question of chayesha, though. It's just a question of... but his life would just be a relatively short period. I just extend it versus the person that I could actually save and live out a full life. Yeah, the question about the question, they're both going to live. Up until now, for the most part, we've dealt with life and death, extending one's life, saving one's life. Look at it, they are both going to live. One will live, I'll be able to save, and he'll live a full, happy, healthy life, and the other one will live a very difficult life. Who comes first? On the flip side, when it's a question of two people to help, one, I can alleviate their suffering. There's two people being equal. One, I will save, I will help, but they will suffer minimally if I don't help them. It will just be a burden. The other one I will help, and they will undergo an awful lot of suffering. Not your question, but the flip side, then, from what we've seen before, in terms of pressing need comes first, then the one who suffers should get the first, should get preferential treatment, just because the needs are greater. Your situation is, I have two people. One I can help and will live a quality life. The other will not, but both will live. And if I don't treat them, both are not going to do too well. It doesn't, from my information, I don't know if that's a factor. I really don't know. Right, let me just rephrase your question. We have a situation which perhaps would be similar you're just thinking to society thing. We originally started off with a situation is, if I will save this person, I will lose my job. Therefore, at least Revolenberg ruled that one is not required to undergo that amount of sacrifice to save someone. However, if let's say your situation is, if I save these people's lives and terminate the space program, or one of the other government programs that are in the government, is a major employer across the country. This is really part of the problem when you're closing military bases, for instance. Now, will I say their livelihood versus people saving people's lives? A few things come to mind. First of all, I'm not, let's say, these people who are working in this, I have two people come in front of me. One I'm going to save, just give you an example, two people are going to come in front of me. One I'm going to save, there's a question, I can give you money, I will save you. The other person, I will give you money and I will just employ you. So my question is, I'll save the other one, and okay, the other one will beg, but at least, because it's my money I'm giving out. So I can give my money out to two people. One who I will give employment to. I can give him a job. I don't need the job. I'll give him the job. With dignity, he'll work, and it won't be a handout. I'll hire him. Or I could take the same money, not hire this person. The person will be forced to beg, and I will go and save somebody with that money. It would seem the greater need is to save the person, and that other person who needs. If I have the money, I should put it towards this, toward this cause, the cause of saving someone. If I have the government, these people are supported year by year by our tax dollars. I am now the gabbai. I am the one who controls these tax dollars. Who should I give it to? The people that are saving, or the people who are going to be out of work? I should do it to the one who's saving. I'm in a different position. If I would be the one out of work, and it's a question of how much sacrifice do I have to undergo, I don't have to undergo that sacrifice, because it's my job. I don't have to give it up. But a third party, who really has a decision making, is a good. Who should he give it to? The third party really should opt to give it to the person who's who needs it the most. Like the difference, who's the one who's going to divvy it up? Just as a parallel to this notion. The Radvaz, he was the chief rabbi of Egypt in the beginning of the 16th century, had a question, a twist on what we had in 3C. 3C is, if you don't kill him, I will kill you. His question was, if you don't kill him, I will mutilate you. I'm going to cut off your ear. I'm not going to do anything. I mean, I'm not going to kill you. I'll just mutilate you. Are you required to undergo mutilation to prevent it wasn't merely that he was going to kill the person. He said, I am going, so the mayor, whatever, says, I am going to kill that person, B. I am going to kill him. If you let me mutilate you, I won't. I'm going to punish either one of you. So it says, either I mutilate you or I kill him. Should the person, the potential mutilee, go and say, well, mutilate me because I'm going to save that other person? So the Ravaz maintains that it's impossible that the Torah should make a demand of a person to undergo mutilation just to save someone. Even though how great the mitzvah of saving is, it's just beyond, they can't make that demand. If he does it, it's a midas chasidus. If he does it, it's a wonderful act. But the Torah can't impose that on someone. It's just too much to impose. Reb Moshe Feinstein used this in a responsa. There were two twins that needed one of the twins lost kidney function. There was a question that the other twin should give up their kidney to help the other one. Is the twin with the healthy kidneys required to be a donor? But Moshe maintained he's not required. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to do, and maybe he should, to impress upon himself the mitzvah of saving a life. One is not required, because there are limits upon which the Torah, oppresses a person. However, even that's the case, if I, as a third party, have a question to prevent a murder or prevent a mutilation, I would prevent the murder. So there's a difference between if I... the onus is on me, or in this situation about the doctor losing the job, or in your situation about closing down the space program to save lives, I, as a third party, may look at it differently.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.